And welcome to Evidence here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Ted Fox.
And I'm Carrie Siegel.
And on today's show, later on, we are going to be talking to Belinda McGuire. She was first on Evidence when we started up around, we started up in late 1999, so early 2000, I believe. And she's now in New York, now dances with the Lamone Company, etc. And she's going to be here talking about her career since Toronto days. First up now, we have Yvonne Ng, and we have Michael Caldwell, and on phone, Lena Cruz. Are you there, Lena?
Yes, hello.
Hi, nice to hear your voice again.
From Montreal.
Direct from Montreal. Okay, so, Yvonne, let's start with you, your background, and then before we get into Dance in Canada.
Oh, my background.
And just as I said that, there was a thunderclap outside,
ooh.
So... You are got a stage presence. You're really great.
Oh, all right. Oh, my God. Okay, how do I start with that? Hi, Lena, by the way.
Hello, Eva.
I'm a dance artist, a choreographer, performer, and arts educator, and as well as, I guess, a presenter, which is why I'm here today. Different role, different hat. We started Dance Made in Canada in 2001, starting with a little program, tiny little platforms. And in 2006, we had this big suggestion. I think nobody knows about this, so this is a good introduction, too. We had a big suggestion from David Morrison, who was a lighting designer in the city, whom I'd often work with artistically. And during one of our breaks, he had this brain, he approached me, this brain wave, brain thought, like whatever, big bulb went into his head, and he said, I guess he'd been thinking about this for a while, and he said, we were already preparing for the next Dance Made in Canada, and he said, you should make this bigger! You could do this and this and that. So he had a whole slew of ideas, and we thought about it, and we brought a pool of people together, Janelle Rainville and Jeff Morris, and it was going to be with David as well, and we were going to pull together and create this festival. But he passed away, sadly, in 2007, we decided to go ahead. I mean, we already had the foundations laid out for Dance Made in Canada. We thought, yeah, let's try and do this, because the bigger dream was to create a larger festival. Mm. Yeah.
And the concept was basically you have, in this festival, Peggy Baker and two other choreographers select who they like.
Yeah. So part of the reiteration for this new format is Peggy, we have guest choreographers now. So myself and always two others. And the two guest choreographers to start this new initiative is Peggy Baker and James Kudelka. And that's really how that went. We looked at all the submissions and looked at all the artists together and went away, did our little homework, and came back and presented our little programs.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit about the programs and who's in it? And then we'll go in with Lena and Michael on their individual works.
Okay. So the breakdown of the whole festival is that there's a main stage program, and there's seven artists, Michael Caldwell and Lena Cruz, Fila 13 Productions being two of them. There's also What You See Is What You Get, WYSIWYG. And that's the late night series, and we wanted to create an opportunity for it to be, you know, to have a lottery section as well as some art encounters events. So there are art installation, photography installation, film, as well as a line dance with Tina Fuchel. And there'll be moderated talks as well. So that's sort of a gist and a little small overview. So with the main stage, there are three programs. Kudelka has curated Lena, Fila 13 Productions, as well as Move the Company, Josh Beamish. Peggy Baker curated and has brought in Jung Ah Chung with D.A. Hoskins choreography, Marie-José Chartier, with her dancers Heidi Strauss and Daryl Tracy, as well as Keiko Ninomaya. Is that right?
Ninomiya.
I always have to slow down when I say her name. Sorry. And then, of course, we have WYSIWYG, which is, you know, anyways, do I have time for that? Can I keep going?
Yes,
oh,
keep
I can
going.
Keep going. Okay, right. All right. He's nodding away at me. Okay. Andrea Spaziani, Jasmine Fife, Robert Steven, Sylvie Bouchard, and, Uh-oh, test. Oh, God, this always happens to me. I really know who they are. I promise. See, now I'm totally blanked. Wait, Andrea, Robert, Sylvie, Jasmine, and, Janine Saranian.
J9
Yes,
Dance.
J9 Dance production, Projects, sorry.
This is quite eclectic.
Yes, very. It'll be fun, yeah.
Now, do you find it interesting what Peggy Morrison, Kodalka, those series, what choreographers they chose?
Yes, of course, yes.
Given what we know about their background and what they liked about here.
Mm-hmm, yes, it was. I mean, we did have a big meeting, and we had a few meetings, and the similarities was curious. Of course, we knew that was going to happen, or I knew that was going to happen, and of course, there are differences, and, you know, before we went into our own private sort of curating time, I said to them that there wasn't a theme. If any theme emerges, you know, from the pool that was the submitted, pool, then see where that takes you. I didn't really want them to get locked into stuff. I wanted the works themselves, the artistic merit of each choreographer, to speak to them. And I knew that by doing that, they would be able, you know, a program, and we talked about programming and the balance and what we're trying to also present to the audience. You know, it is a mixed program. Each program is an hour long, so you had to really consider all those factors too. So, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's 11 to 14th at the Betty Oliphant. Mm-hmm. I forgot to mention that at the top of the show. A nice large space.
It is. That was one of David's. We were already at Betty Oliphant, and he said, you know, you should just be there even more. And there's not a lot of theaters that's built for dance, mm-hmm, and to house us for that whole time. We needed that space and time, and the stage itself is built for dance, and that's hard to find. And so I know it's a huge stage, but it's also a very flexible space within, you know, so we knew we could work with that, so we just jumped in and thought, well, we were already going to be there, and like we were already there, so we thought, yeah, let's just keep going with this. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So, Michael, she said it's a huge space, and this is a solo you're doing, right?
Yes, it is, yes.
So, how does that feel to you, being there?
Well, it is a very large space, but I've been collaborating with my lighting designer, Ron Snipe, the infamous Ron Snipe. And he
infamous?
Is, yeah, of course, infamous now, with the Dance Ontario Lifetime Achievement Award that he received recently.
Oh,
so,
yes.
So, you know, he's big stuff now. So, so Ron and I really, really talked, and one of the things that he did with lighting was really sort of reduce the space and keep it very intimate. It's something that he was very firm with at the beginning at trying to do, and I just sort of went along with his suggestion. And so most of my choreography fits within the lighted space that he's provided for me. So,
Let's have a bit of background on yourself for those who don't know your work.
Sure. My name is Michael Caldwell, and I am originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm a choreographer and performer in dance. I came to Toronto about 9 years ago after completing a bachelor's degree at Syracuse University in film and art history. I originally came here to go to the University of Toronto in museum studies, of all things, and quit after a semester and realized that dance was my great joy and my great passion. So
Not fossilized.
No, not fossilized. So from there, I went to audition to the School of Toronto Dance Theater, was accepted, went there for 3 years, and graduated in 2006, and since then I've been dancing up a storm everywhere in Toronto.
Mm-hmm. And around the world.
Around the world.
Yeah, yeah.
So what is the piece that you're going to be doing?
The piece that I'm doing is a solo choreography that I've created and I'm performing myself. The title is Ash Unravel, and it's really specifically based on two very sort of personal events in my life. The first was the death of my mother in September 2008, and the second was my first trip ever to the country of Vietnam in May 2010. And from these both of these experiences, I sort of collected a lot of emotions and feelings and the different, you know, personal memories that I had of both experiences and sort of infused them into my solo.
Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a little bit about the texture of the piece and how it relates to that theme?
Certainly. You know, when I was first going to create this piece, I knew that I had to create something based on my mother, because since my mother passed away, you know, anytime I walked into the studio to do any kind of improv or any kind of choreography, you know, she would just pop into my mind. Like, it's just such a poignant experience in my life. So I knew that I had to do something related to it. I received an Ontario Arts Council National and International Residency Grant to go to Vietnam at one point. And when I did, it was, you know, this may sound a little cliche, but it was a life-changing experience. It really was. For the first time in my entire life, I felt as though I belonged somewhere. I always feel a little bit like the other, because I'm mixed heritage, and I'm American, I'm Canadian, where am I? I don't know what I am, and all this kind of stuff. So when I finally went to Ken Tho, which is a small city in the south of Vietnam, I felt like I belonged. I saw people that looked like me, that walked like me, that had the same smile, had the same hand gestures, like very, very wow. Interesting stuff. So when it came time to create and come back, when I came back from Vietnam and create this solo, I just went back into the studio. I had written a journal. I'm not a big journal writer, but I kept a journal of every day I was in Vietnam. And just went through and just read through it, and then started to just improvise in the studio, improvise to the point of exhaustion, find different states of being, and that's really more or less what's in the work, I would say. It's a lot of being extremely physical to the point of exhaustion, and then finding a state of being that I've arrived in, that I then can show to the audience. Is essentially what it is about.
And the title, Ash Unravel?
Ash Unravel, yes. For me, ash is, you know, after because the Vietnam War, my parents met during the Vietnam War. After war, there's obviously a lot of destruction, and really ashes remain. And then if you think about loved ones that have passed, if they're cremated, there's also ashes that are left. So for me, ashes are the last thing that's left, but also the first thing that in which you can spring from. So when you when you think about the ashes, because my mother was actually cremated, so when I think about her ashes, I'm like, okay, this is my mother now. Where do I go from here? Mm-hmm. And really, that's the question I'm ruminating on with this solo.
It sounds like when you describe what you're doing with the work, mm-hmm. there's like a poetic resonance between those two descriptions as well, like pushing the body to a state of exhaustion. It's mm-hmm. kind of like the body becomes ash, and then it's kind of like the connection of life and death and the body unraveling and mm-hmm. in life.
Yes, absolutely. A lot of my work is based on the theme of loss, whether it's loss of innocence or loss of a loved one, and loss in a very broad term, and yes, the body, through being in the state of exhaustion, does lose some of its clarity, and you get to this place where yes, in a way, it could be very poetic in that there's ashes left, but also just your mind is completely blank, and at that point, what fills the void, and that to me is what's really interesting, like what enters the mind at that point. And that's the essence of the solo.
Yeah. That's kind of like death, too.
Yeah.
You reach that certain point of going somewhere else.
Yeah.
Do you find it in any way a spiritual experience going through this? And does it affect your choreography? And how?
In loose terms, yes. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't want to call it spiritual, because I don't think it's at quite that level of thought with all the very spiritual thinkers in the world. But I think on a personal level, I think it's helped me to reconnect and sort of uncover some of the mysteries of my mother and my father, their upbringing and how they met and all that kind of stuff. So in that way, I feel like her spirit is with me a bit more. It always has been, but it's traveling with me. So, yeah.
Are the spirits of the two cultures embodied in your movement?
The two cultures meaning
Vietnam, your mm-hmm. homeland, and reminding over here on this side of the ocean. Mm-hmm. How do they affect your movement vocabulary? How would we...
Right. I mean, certainly... That's a very good question. My formal dance training and everything that I've done, as far as dance is concerned, has been here in North America. So really what you're seeing is the sort of the physical body is really based in Canada. Dance Made in Canada festival.
I paid him to say that.
Lena, if you have any comments, please join in here on this.
I find it very interesting listening to Michael and to Yvonne before. Yeah.
But when it comes to the Vietnamese culture, I think a lot of the internal emotions that I'm thinking about are really based on the Vietnamese culture, the Vietnamese people that I met on my journey. My mother, of course, who was half Vietnamese, half Chinese, but grew up in Vietnam. So I think that's sort of where the divide lies a bit, and trying to find within the solo a place where those two merge.
Mm-hmm. Lena, when you work as a I find in your work too in some ways, right? Your culture coming out. How does it work?
I don't know. if you see it, I guess, yeah. I don't know in what way you mean. Perhaps I know that some people, because of the multiple images, because there's often a lot going on, they think of the type of writing that is like a bit like Garcia Marquez, who is sort of a surrealist writing. There's a lot happening, there's a lot of characters and a lot of colors, or like those paintings that are called naive, where you have description of things that happen in a little town, but you have a lot of little scenes at the same time. So maybe in that sense I would say yes. Then when I do my work, my solo work, it's very strange, I don't know where it comes from, but I find that there's a Japanese thing coming from somewhere, and I'm not Japanese at all. So that is very strange. And sometimes even Indian. So, I mean, India, from India. So it's hard to tell what we are influenced by, you know. Because I come from South America. I come from Colombia. So, I mean, between Colombia and Japan, there's like a...
Well, I find some of your work sort of verging on... Or maybe not verging. That's a word. Magic realism.
Yes.
Yes, very much.
Oh,
so.
Okay. I see what you mean. Like a shaman kind of thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
And dreamlike and surreal.
Yeah,
all those words come to mind.
Yeah. Dreamlike, definitely. I'm in love with falling asleep and having adventures while I sleep.
Yeah. And having costume design consist of pots and pans and various utensils on the body. I've seen a piece of that.
Yes.
So, you do this. What's your background?
My background is ballet, all from the beginning until today. It's still there. Then I did several modern styles. So there was a period where I started Graham and Limon, and then jazz, also several styles. And then I also did some African dance at one point, and some music hall also. And then I did karate for 6 years, which really marked my life and my body and my everything. And I think a lot, maybe that, but the Japanese was there before, though. But I guess the Japanese part in me went to look for the karate. So so that's basically, as far as training and background, that would be it, yeah. And I have to say also the fact that I lived in Spain for a long time and now here, so obviously the culture around you also has an impact, an influence. So I don't think I can see it myself, but I've been here 20 years in Montreal, so I'm sure that it has done something to me.
And the piece that you're performing, can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, the piece... doesn't have a storyline, and it does not have a definite inspiration. I used to work with solos. I mean, I still do. But my first solos were always guided by a very clear inspiration and almost a scenario before I started working. Like, I wanted to have a definite character that lives something specifically and goes from A to B in a certain way, and even how it moves on stage, and everything was, like, pre-designed. And now with the group pieces, I wanted to break away from that. So with the previous piece, K5, I already started trying to free myself of that need to have a storyline. And it was hard, but I got the taste for it. And but with K5, there was still a sense of I saw it more like a tribe, mm-hmm. and like if you could see on stage things that a tribe is living. So that's mm-hmm. the way I saw it. But this piece now doesn't even have that sense for me. I really went like a free association of ideas. And like a patchwork, like a collage of ideas, allowing myself to. This, there was an idea that I liked. You put it in there, and then you put the next one, and then you put the next one, and then you just try to make it flow, to make it work together. And that's in a way why it became the name Soup du Jour, because you throw in there bits and pieces in a large melting pot and pray. Pray that it's not too salty or not too, yeah. So, and even now doing 25 minutes of the piece, it's even more condensed soup, so.
And the role of the musician in this piece?
Oh, yes. Yeah, actually, Toronto is very important in that for me. Because in 2000 I was asked by Jim Montgomery from the Canadian Electronic Ensemble to choreograph some solos on their music, and then we performed, and the musicians were live on stage. And ever since, I stopped dancing with recorded music. So it was such a revelation for me to have these people on stage, creating or producing the sound at the same time that I was dancing, that I said, this is it, this has to continue, even though it's difficult, it's financially mm-hmm. more demanding, but also as far as making availabilities match, etc. So ever since 2000, I've been working with musicians on stage, and then slowly came the need to integrate them so that they're not just doing the music, but that they're part of the aesthetics of the piece, that there's an exchange too between the dancers and the music, so that the dancers participate with simple sounds or simple actions that make noise, or and then sometimes the musician can come in and have an interaction with the dancer. So there's that too. And in the excerpt we're presenting, there's less of that because the piece is 50 minutes long, and there's a section where the musician dances actually with the dancers, but in the excerpt we are presenting that particular part is not there.
So how does this change the dance experience for the dancer? Because I find something really interesting happens when you bring sound or speech particularly to dance. There's a definite shift that happens.
Yes there is. I think most dancers are now used to being asked to speak. Mm-hmm. So when you get used to it, it becomes part of your breath, which I think is the interesting part of it as far as with Wellness Speak technically, is that if you use your breath in a way that flows mm-hmm. at the same time that you're moving, it helps the movement too. Mm-hmm. So in that way, I imagine it must be. It must be like almost relieving then, and instead of just trying to hold your breath, kind of. And but what we do is try to. It's always sort of musical. I haven't yet gone into saying something like really text. It's more like you mm-hmm. if you say, for example, I am a man. You say, I am a man. So that, I guess that's where it comes to the level of dream, perhaps. You know, everything is a bit woozy. Well, dreams or drugs, I don't know. I don't take drugs, but but I can imagine. So.
Okay, you also, there's also, Yvonne, classes, workshops.
Yes,
and Lena, you
that.
Have one Sunday, August the 14th, 10:30
yes.
to 12 noon at the National Ballet School.
Yes.
Can you describe very briefly what you're going to do in that class?
Well, it's ballet because my background is ballet, and I'm totally in love with this technique and with analyzing it and exploring it. I've been teaching for more than 25 years, and always at like pre-professional and professional levels. So I'm very passionate about being able to be useful to the professional world, you know, to the milieu, for the dancers to train, etc. So that's what I do, but always with there's a personal touch, and it's very open to mixing styles, but always keeping the ballet technique because it is a ballet class. So that's what I'm offering in that 1 hour and a half is a ballet class, but it has a little, you know, a little touch, a little twist. It's a bit different. And Philippe will be playing the piano, the Philippe Noirot, okay, who is in the piece as a musician.
Right. Now there's others, Yvonne, too.
Yes, Jung Ah is also teaching, as well as Dalek, Machine Noisy. You know what? Oh, huh? Machine Noisy, who are they?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, you will get to know them soon enough. They're from Vancouver. Actually, Dalek, I hope I said this correctly, but he had lived in Toronto and then moved out to Vancouver and danced with Peter Bingham and formed his own company, Machine Noisy. So his partner is Dahlia Brett. They'll be coming out to do their work and also teaching the workshop, and that'll be at Dove House Dance. That's my space. And Jung Ah Chung will also be teaching, and she'll be teaching at the Betty Oliphant during the week. So you know what? Go to Facebook, because all our events, all the workshop details, it's probably easier because there's a lot of information to give you right now.
So is there a thing they put in for Facebook?
Just Dance Made in Canada. Just go find us on Dance Made in Canada, FAO Canada, and check out the events section. It breaks it all down. The main stage program, the WYSIWYG, all the art encounters.
I love the name.
I know, WYSIWYG. I know, I like it too. Art encounters, as well as all the workshop programs that we have, as well as any of the pre-show and post-show chats. That's all in there.
And what about princessproductions.ca on the web too?
Yes, you can go there. But most people just go through, I know, I just keep saying that, go to Facebook, because most people are there. I know you guys are all out there on Facebook, so just go there. Yeah.
Now, Lena, when's your first show?
It's on the 12th.
On the 12th. Mm-hmm. And you have two more after that. So
yes.
Yeah. And yours?
My first show's on the 11th at 9 p.m. And then I have Friday off, and then Saturday at 7 and Sunday at 2.
Okay. And we have two pairs of tickets to give away. One for Friday, August 12th, 7 p.m. That's the Kadelka series, and that features Lena. And the number to call is 416-946-7000, 416-946-7000. And also one pair of tickets to the Baker Series, which is Friday, August the 12th as well at 9 p.m. And again, 416-946-7000. Just wait a moment before you phone, because we have a phoner here with Lena. Hey! And I'd like to thank you, Lena, for
thank you so much, Ted and Yvonne.
Yeah, thank you.
And Michael and Yvonne.
Yeah.
And we'll see you all at Dance in Canada, hopefully. Yay. And coming up, Belinda McGuire here on CIUT 89.5 FM.
Thank you.
This is CIUT 89.5 FM, the University of Toronto Community Radio Station. Available across Canada on Star Choice National Satellite Service, Channel 826, and broadcasting worldwide at www.ciut.fm.
CIUT 89.5 FM brings you Free the Funk at the Gladstone Hotel, Thursday, August 25th from 8 p.m. Come dance while summer's still hot to the beats of CIUT's DJs Jason Palma, Dan Toner, Parkdale Funk, and many more. Tickets are $10 at the door. Check out CIUT.fm for more details. Come on, free the funk!
the dark some parts of you. You done the dark some parts of me. We win, win, win. Tell something like a quilt to cruise, all patch of me and swatch of you. We wrap up through a sparrow tree, love with crying birds for fruit. Oh, so a sparrow tree, love with crying birds for fruit. Oh, so a sparrow. WC Woods, your dress in galosh green and trim your topiary. Birds and topiary bees, jewels bring your jars of shells and bring a volume of your pet ghost's poetry. Don't you try to hide it from me.
So spare it. So a sparrow tree, love with crying birds for fruit. Oh, so a sparrow tree.
Martha, my dear, Francis, my bliss and my favorite frost to wear our long wise white beards. And when the truth, one, two, three, four, we sister wives will ride on one white bike. The speed of a quail, then we'll stand upright, one on each white side of a whale, wishbone and tug of war. Rebecca, they sent us twin red-headed boys, so let's dress them all their days in purple boys. Oh, I hope you find your ambergris. 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 I hope you find.
Hi, welcome back to Evidence, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Ted Fox.
And I'm Carrie Siegel.
And what was that piece, Carrie?
That was a beautiful song called Ambergris by Snowblink, who is
that's right,
a local
Snowblink
artist.
Yes, they were the ones that originally worked with Kathleen Ray on a piece about her father's illness 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And now they're becoming really big and have been in Signal on CBC an awful lot now, and I highly recommend them myself. Anyway, welcome, Belinda.
Thank you.
Been happening to you.
Yeah.
And let's go way back. with Canadian Children's Dance Theatre. Do you remember many memories of that and what it was like being there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. I was there for maybe nine years. I left when I graduated high school, which would have been in 2002. Mm. But those were some really, really, really self-shaping years of my life. And I keep in touch. I still rehearse there. When I come back into town, for example, like this week. Mm-hmm.
How would you describe what you got out of dance training then when you were as a teen in children's dance theater and how it's made you now? helped you get where you are now?
Yeah. Well, it was really like an empowering kind of education. Through our classes, we learned not only technical capacity building, but also we learned how to be our own teacher. It really opened our perception so that through studying the Limon technique, we gained our awareness of dynamic and direction and coordination, lots of things that would help us to do the Limon technique, but then also lots of skills and instincts that transfer into many different techniques, and even working with choreographers who don't work within a specific technique. I feel like those classes and learning with those teachers, Donna Krasnow, Deborah Lundmark, Arwen Carpenter, really gave us the tools to allow us to work in many different with many different artists.
Mm-hmm. And from there, you went to Juilliard.
Yes, and I graduated from Juilliard in 2006. I had some wonderful teachers there too. Was able to focus on many different things and really apply myself. And then I joined Doug Verona Dancers, a company in New York, and danced with them for about 2 years. Then I freelanced for about a year and joined the Limon Company about 2 or 3 years ago. And now I'm dancing with the Limon Company and also pursuing some independent projects.
And the Juilliard experience, can you speak on the influence of that into your work?
Mm-hmm. So at Juilliard, as with at CCDT, we studied equally ballet and modern, but it was for the first time in my life something that I could focus on exclusively, because that's what we did. All day long. We had some classes in humanities and things like that, but for the most part we were in the studio being physical. And we also had some really wonderful exposure to other artists, both in the form of guest artists coming to work with us, people from all around the world, but then also our fellow students came from all over the world. And one of my classmates, Idan Sharabi, is now back in Tel Aviv. It's where he's originally from. He was the first Israeli dancer I ever saw and ever danced with, and I had never seen anything like him before. And another good friend and classmate, Harumi Teriyama, she's dancing with Cedar Lake in New York. I just saw the Adjustment Bureau last night, which is the movie the company that's featured there is an actual company in New York, and I have a bunch of friends there too. So anyway, she's from Japan and moved also in a different way. So it really expanded my perception of what you can do with movement and how you can use it to speak.
Can you talk a little bit about the nuances of the differences of that movement?
Mm-hmm. Well, through our technique classes, we studied Limon, Graham, Taylor, Cunningham, and started to get into Gaga, which is it's a technique. I guess you could call it a technique that is based off of the work of Ohad Naharin, who's the director of Bacheva Dance Company in Tel Aviv. And I don't know, this is sort of a chicken or the egg situation, I think, which indicates why I don't know which started which, but Ohad Naharin started a movement or technique called Gaga, and it is sort of synonymous now with the movement identity, I think, of dance in Israel. It's really informed by sort of real-time sensation, awareness, and response. The class, I've taken a few Gaga classes, and it seems, a part of it seems to be sort of a guided journey that the teacher leads the students on through sort of the inner eye, the inner eye's look at your body, and all the movement in the class is generated in some way by what you're feeling or what you're imagining, and it totally in some parts of class, you are just people wiggling around. But Ohad Naharin uses that as that approach to teach his choreography, and when he's making new pieces or setting new pieces, and it really the end result when you see his company, and I see this also in other Israeli dancers, is that when there's a moment of unison, for example, you know, in the complete other end of the spectrum would be, you know, the corps de ballet in Swan Lake, where everything is happening precisely together, the same angles, the same lines, the same timing. With his company, there's he's found a way to create unison that's just as precise, except rather than everyone, the movement happening exactly the same way at the same time, everyone's moved by exactly the same instinct, mm-hmm. or at least that's what it that's what it appears to me. Sort of like if all five dancers, for example, put their hand on a hot coal, the way that they're all responding to the same stimulus, I guess, and so it creates a different kind of unison that's really powerful.
It seems like it makes me think of some of the Bhutto performances that I've seen, mm-hmm. where there's an internal stimuli, and the synchness is that everyone is has an internal score that they're enacting.
Yeah,
which creates the symmetry in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, and then essentially, and this idea really appeals to me, the choreography is not the design of an outcome, i.e. you circle your leg and then you reach your hand, and then but the choreography is the design of events, and then what the dance becomes is a reaction to those designed events, I guess.
Which creates like an authentic response in a way.
Yeah.
And so the piece that you're working on, can you talk a bit about that?
Oh, sure. So right now, actually, well, starting at 10:30, I'll be rehearsing with Sharon Moore. Sharon and I have been working on a solo piece that she's creating on me over the past year and a half. We work in sort of weekly or biweekly increments, spread over time, and we think that this is going to be our sort of final creation week. We have 17 minutes or so worth of like really dense, really rich, really like characterful material that needs to be kind of shaped and crafted, and so we're gonna dig into that. Sharon, there are aspects of her choreography that have that same reliance on sort of real-time reaction, spontaneity, and in order to do the movement, you have to kind of set yourself up so that you're reacting to events that you create although you can't know that they're coming before they happen otherwise. So it kind of feels like when I'm dancing the piece, I kind of have to run two levels of consciousness at the same time. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'd like to get a bit about Lamone. What's it like dancing with that company? And for those who don't know, a bit about the technique that mm-hmm. you utilize, the famous Lamone technique.
Yes. So I started dancing with the Lamone Company in 2009-ish, and I've been studying in the technique through my years at CCDT, and it's full of breath. It's some of the main kind of physical themes that come up are fall and recovery, rebound and suspension. These are all sort of opposites, and propel each other too. So by falling, the fall causes the rebound. The rebound causes the suspension. So the technique is filled with like real physics, in the same way that that Israeli dance and Sharon dance appeals to me. Lamone also appeals to me because when you're watching it, you're watching real things happen. You're watching a phrase of movement is really a series of sort of mousetrap like. The game Mousetrap, cause and effects. At least that's the way that I see it. It's a beautiful technique, and there's a lot of really gorgeous, touching repertoire that he's left behind, and it's a joy to be able to do that. In the company.
Right. Now, one thing you mentioned in your website is mm-hmm. being fascinated by the impermanence of things and the pursuit of sensitivity. Can you just elaborate a bit? I found that an interesting thing because dance is impermanent. A lot of the things you were talking about in the rehearsal process with Sharon and the other about movement changing a bit mm-hmm. by bit, but also... now, even as an archived, I don't think our dance history archives are keeping up to date with what's happening. So it's just current, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the pursuit of sensitivity kind of taps into that thing about dance that really appeals to me, that that it really is a live art form. When you're watching dance, you're watching people respond to real physics that are really happening, and that inherently have dramatic repercussions. And so whether it's an abstract piece or, you know, a piece with a story to it, that's still an important part. That as you're dancing, you're responding. So as I take class, as I teach class, as I work in rehearsal, as I create new work, as I learn works that have been around for ages, that's a common thing that I use to approach each of those different working scenarios. And the impermanence of things. So these choreographers that I've mentioned, Ohad Naharin, Jose Lamone, Sharon Moore, Idan Shirabi, whether they would describe it this way or not, my my experience of their work is that there is an underlying design, which is the design of events or the design of stimulus or stimuli. And so if I'm performing a Limon piece that was choreographed years and years and years ago, it's still a live thing. It's not the same that it was back then, but it's never been the same way twice, because the response to each stimulus has been a little bit different each time, but you're sort of set up to head on the same kind of journey.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
Can you put in words to describe what that stimulus might be, say, in a Limon piece?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you might start by swinging one body part, and based on sort of the trajectory of the swing or the depth of the swing, that might influence the way that your alignment of your spine changes, and the way that the alignment of your spine changes might shift your weight over to the right foot, which might allow your left foot to swing open, which might allow your weight to shift in that direction, which might cause you to gain enough momentum to like head into a jump, and then that jump is a suspension which has to cause a fall, which then, you know, the fall has a rebound, and you can use a rebound to send you in multiple different directions. And so one thing, you know, the initial swing sets off a series of these events that you can kind of shape or guide, like tossing a ball, but you can't hold on to the ball through the entire trajectory of its movement. You could, but then, you know, the game wouldn't be fun that way.
Well done.
Well, this is a good way to end it. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to thank you very much, Belinda, for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for
having
me.
Belinda McGuire, and you have a website.
Yes, www.belindamcguire.org.
Very simple.
Yeah, yes. Pretty straightforward.
And I'd like to thank Yvonne, David, and Lena for coming on, talking about their works and Dance Made in Canada, Canada Festival, which takes place August the 11th to 14th at Toronto's Betty Oliphant Theatre. And princessproductions.ca is the website, and also, as Yvonne mentioned, just go on Facebook. Next week isn't firmed up quite as yet, but upcoming shows, we are going to be talking to Lona Doherty about Apathy is Boring, Valerie Boodle, who works with Jose Navas on Flax in Montreal, and also Catherine Miller from Dance, the director of Dance UK, talking about the British dance scene. I'd like to thank Carrie on Tech, and we'll see you next week here on CIUT 89.5 FM.